From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Lately, you've probably heard about a certain hit Netflix show. And by that, I mean Ugly Delicious and its star David Chang. In 2004, Chang opened Momofuku Noodle Bar in New York's East Village. Since then, we've watched him spin off one successful concept after another, from tasting menus to fried chicken sandwiches to soft serve. Along the way, David has gone from a pork bun genius to a singular culinary voice, showing a new generation of chefs how to be owners and creators.
I'm tired of being edited out.
That's David Chang.
And I don't care if you guys think it's stupid. I know it's delicious, and we just need to give it a platform so other people can find it and taste it, because maybe they've never had it before.
Today, Chang's Momofuku empire includes restaurants in New York, Toronto, Las Vegas, and as far as Sydney. But now, we can also add L.A. to that list with the arrival of Major Domo. Bill Addison of Eater recently called it the most exciting restaurant to open this year. Chang's ambitions are bigger than food. Just recently, he also announced a new multimedia company called Major Domo Media. So, world domination?
I was like, wow, that doesn't seem like a lot.
It didn't make you feel tired.
I was having the moment that I feel like when I'm with my shrink, where I'm like, oh no, like this is all too much.
So I have to ask you first about PyeongChang and the Winter Olympics. You were a special correspondent for NBC. Millions of people were seeing you on TV every night. I think back to, you know, when I first opened my place, like even 20 years ago, it would have been unthinkable for a chef to be such a visible part of a major international televised sports event. So what was that like for you? And it was live. Did that terrify you?
Yes. PyeongChang, NBC Olympics, I still can't believe that it happened. And if I sound like I'm in disbelief with everything in life, it's really genuine. So back in the day when we opened up, Jim Bell, who now runs the Olympics for NBC, used to come to Noodle Bar, like right after they would wrap up for the Today Show, because that's what he used to run. And I'd feed him, and he was just like a regular guest, and didn't hear from him for a while. And then like 2 years ago, he's like, hey, would you want to potentially participate in the Winter Olympics? And I was like, what, is this a joke? Like, chefs don't do this. He's like, well, no, you know what, food, and I think it was telling about where food is in the world today. It's like, well, you know, I think one of the best ways for people to understand Korea is to talk about food. And I was like, oh, maybe this would be a cool trip. I love the Olympics. I'm a sports nut. This is going to be great. And I didn't contemplate the fact that it would be live. I didn't contemplate the fact that millions of people were going to be watching it. You do, but it didn't really hit me until I was there. And it was the first time in my life where I genuinely understood the significance of the moment and the fact that I had to represent not just like Asian Americans and Americans to Korean food, but the fact that I was going to represent Korean people. And I thought I was not maybe the best candidate for that. And that was like, it screwed with my head.
Let's talk more about Ugly Delicious. And I guess I should full disclose that I appear in an episode and a half. One of the things that really struck me when I started to sit down and binge the episodes was how different the point of view is, because it's your point of view. And so many of the shows, the culinary shows we see on Netflix, are either way pulled back to a more generalist view, like Chef's Table. And it's rare to have the issues be seen through such a personal lens. So you are Korean-American. Mm-hmm. What's fascinating to me is how Asian the lens is throughout Ugly Delicious, throughout all the conversations. It's almost like you've been keeping a tally of all the times you felt marginalized or insulted.
Yes.
And now you're getting back by engaging and trying to tease it out for yourself.
Yeah. Well, Evan, I think you just definitely summarize a lot of it. It's not a perfect viewpoint, and it's definitely subjective how I view the world. And I know that it can be sometimes bombastic, and I'm sometimes like a, you know, bowling ball in a china shop. And that's just how I learn and how I figure out things and perceive things. And one of the things I've definitely carried throughout my life was the fact that I'm not like everyone else. I'm not like the Koreans that my parents want me to hang out with, and I'm not like all the other essentially white kids that I grew up with. And I didn't realize until probably the past 3-4 years where it's become something that I'm more comfortable with is being in my own skin. I think that just happens with age. But for a long time, I think I ran away from who I was and what I wanted to do, literally moving away or moving away from the food that I grew up eating. And I think, as you said, like this perspective of being an Asian is not the only subject that we're talking about, but it's definitely how I feel like I've viewed the world for many, many years. And, you know, that's one thing I'm really proud of, right? I know that it's not a perfect show, but we're able to talk about things that I don't think have been talked about to our audience on Netflix, at least, right? So I don't know. It's a lot. It's a lot for me to unpack.
So let's talk about the Stuffed episode for a minute. In the Stuffed episode, you sort of go on an exploration of dumplings, and you use the Italian tradition of stuffed pastas as an example of a less diverse, more poorly evolved dumpling situation.
Right. Sometimes it's hard to explain this, that it's still sort of TV, and not every position is a position that I genuinely, like, believe in, but I think it's a construct to get to a place that I think that we want to believe in. And I love Italian food. I'm not saying that. I'm simply saying, wait a second, how is it that Italian Americans, which is around 20 to 25 million people in America, same to the aggregate of Asian Americans, have a cuisine that's widely more respected than I think Asian food, particularly in how it's the cost of it in restaurants, like it's more expensive and how it's just beloved, not just in America, but the world over. And when I take a look at many of the same ingredients, many of the same dishes, I can't think but what makes it so different, right? And that bothered me. And again, many of my friends are some of the best Italian chefs in America. And I just was always, would be like jokingly like, that's crap that you get to serve these dumplings for $27. And I go to Ding Tai Fung or someplace in the SGV or Keng Keng Food Court, right? I love that place. And it's like $4. And I understand there's ambiance. And I understand that like, it's not about making Asian dumplings more expensive. While that would be a great thing, it's simply understanding what are we actually trying to value here.
See, I find it really interesting because I'm really aware that 100 years ago, that's how Italian food was viewed.
Yes.
They were the dirty people from the whole country, and their food was garbage, and there was so much, you know, what is really in a ravioli could be sawdust. You don't know what's in there. It's all hidden. Let's talk about tacos because, you know, we're in Los Angeles. I was shocked by your willingness to reveal yourself as not a taco fan.
I just wanted to be honest, right? And that's something I think when we began this venture with Morgan Neville, Eddie Schmidt, and the whole team at Tremolo and Pete, and trying to figure out how to tell an honest point of view. And the fact of the matter is I grew up in Northern Virginia to Korean parents, and then I spent a lot of time in Asia and then a lot of time in New York City. While I've traveled the world over, I'm not a taco expert, and just because I'm a chef doesn't mean that I'm an expert in anything. I just happen to cook the things that I think are delicious. And one, unfortunately, but something I'm proud to acknowledge is I know almost nothing about Mexican food other than I love to eat it. Other than I know that it has a vibrant, rich history, but by no means am I going to be like, oh, yeah, this is this and this. Like, not everyone can know everything.
That's the beauty of that episode, I think. Watching you in the car with Gustavo and Jonathan and Pete going from taco place to taco place and having them sort of enlighten you, there's something very classical literature about the whole thing.
I mean, I'm just sort of a dummy going through it. And I was amazed when I realized the connection between the Middle East and Mexico. I was like, how the hell is this even possible? And I really came away with a genuine fascination because I think that Japan is like the highest level of cuisine in terms of how they incorporate from the rest. I call them like the Borg from Star Trek. They just take from everything. Not necessarily always better, but Mexico, wouldn't put in that same category, but they are. They take from everywhere and they turn it into something that's their own. And I think that was beautiful. I did not know that. The food was delicious. So tacos are great.
I didn't mean to try.
My joke is this. I'm always going to compare everything to Asian food. I just can't help it. So I know that might bother some people, but it doesn't mean that I don't love tacos.
But I think it's more than you compare it to Asian food. You compare it to your experience.
Right.
Right. So that's your experience. Could you talk a little bit about growing up in your family? Your family's from North Korea, right?
My dad was born close to the what is now China and North Korea. And my mother came from sort of way more privileged, like an hour outside of Seoul. And they met after the Korean War. But my dad loves food, immigrated to this country, the youngest of 11 kids, and worked in the restaurant industry from New York going all the way down to the D.C. area for 30-plus years. And he genuinely worked his entire life to make sure I would never work in restaurants. In fact, he wanted me to be a pro golfer before it was cool. And my mom's a tremendous cook. And I spent most of my earlier years, because my parents worked so much, with my grandmother, my mom's mom. And she was a fantastic cook, too. I just spent most of my days with her. And I never really understood all the great food I was eating, because I always grew up later thinking, oh, that was weird, right? Snacking on dried fish and peanuts, and she would be cooking it over the fire for me, like, that was amazing. And I really, really didn't understand what was going on until much later in life. And food was the way that my family expressed, like, we just communicated, because they don't talk, we don't talk to each other that much. It's very, like short commands. But over food, like many great families that have great food, I think that's how we could communicate.
I love the relationship between you and your mother that's revealed in the show. I mean, this is a woman who is hard as nails,
yes.
A brain cancer survivor.
Yes.
And she's such a critic. Everything you do, she's just such a, she has to put you in your place.
Yes. Again, like, I didn't realize how much she did that until recently, because that's just how I always grew up. Like, I didn't realize how, I won't say snarky, but sarcastic she was with me. And she would always call me Wang Jianim growing up. And it wasn't until, again, a few years ago when someone said, hey, you know, that's not a, like a real term of endearment. That basically means you're a brat. And she has to deal with you, Dave. And I was like, oh, that sort of sucks. I didn't see it that way. But my mom is, the older I get, the more I genuinely appreciate, because she's just been so loving and so caring. And I grew up thinking that my dad, because he's in North Korea, was the hard one and he was the tough one. But, I mean, he is like weak sauce compared to my mom, genuinely. And when we filmed that, the reason why I think we allowed it to happen at my home was I didn't know if my mom was going to make it. You know, she was really sick during that episode. And I was like, I think the only way we were going to be able to, like, capture any of this would be if this happens. And the fact that she was there and she allowed that to happen, that was great. So I'm over the moon that many people are, like, big fans of my mom, because she's just the best.
Let's take a short break. In a moment, more of my conversation with David Chang.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I've been talking to David Chang, chef and creator of Momofuku and the Netflix show Ugly Delicious. What about the critiques? There have been a few think pieces out there arguing that there could have been more women in Ugly Delicious.
Mm-hmm. I have a lot to say about this, and what I don't want to say is rationalize what happened, right? I've been processing all this criticism, and it guts me to hear that we didn't represent not just women, but African Americans and South America, you name it. But at the top of the list, obviously, I think one of the biggest criticisms is the lack of representation of women, not just in the home kitchen. And I felt that we tried our best, and it wasn't good enough. So
you did have other segments in there that didn't make it into
We did. We did, but that's the thing. It's like, this is such a slippery slope, and the last thing I want to do is just be defensive or rationalize it. And I've had, 3 weeks to process this, and all I can say is it was not our goal to have people feel this way. Not at all. And if given another opportunity, hopefully we'll get better at this, because that's definitely the goal. And That was definitely not our intent. In fact, we actually tried very hard to incorporate it as much as possible. So I think it was a little bit, not shocking, but it definitely hurt to hear that sentiment because that was not our intent at all.
Let's talk about food. Major Domo opened, and I was there at one of the early dinners, and you seemed genuinely nervous, which is really surprising considering how many restaurants you've opened. What did this particular opening sort of symbolize or mean for you? And talk a bit about the food and what sort of where your palate is, why you were choosing some of the things on the menu.
Well, this restaurant opening was super important. I mean, I put a lot of pressure on myself and the team because I thought that I was envisioning in my mind that this was the only restaurant that we had and that if it didn't work, then everything was going to fail. And that's a lot of pressure to put on myself, but that's literally how I viewed it, that nothing else mattered. And while we still have amazing restaurants and I think they're doing great, that's just, I needed to get myself in a mindset that it was all on the line. And I think after 5 years, so I think from 35 to 40, it was a weird stretch where it wasn't middle age. It was like, am I even good at this anymore? Like, what's happening? And then you're growing, and you try to delegate, and then you have the younger crop of girls and guys coming in. And, like, I just think maybe they're better than me now. Maybe I'm over the hill. And then it was sort of a confidence issue and delegating, learn how to communicate. And I think that affected a lot of things, and I just wasn't confident in the direction where I thought I could take food. And Major Domo was a place when we signed that lease, it was almost 3 years ago when I was like, oh, this is going to be really hard. It's going to be really hard.
Why?
Historically, for me, I don't know if I get the best out of myself unless I know I'm in a difficult situation. It's almost like getting a paper done at the last minute, right? I'm just a procrastinator, but I'm not really a procrastinator, but mentally, for me to push myself out of my comfort zone, I need to be in uncomfortable places. And I think that location really spoke to me as, wait, no one's going to come here unless we do something really, you know, aiming to do something extraordinary. And for a city that I've been coming to my entire life, to LA, I didn't want this to be a place where people felt that it was anything but like our best work that we could give. And simultaneously, because LA, I knew that we needed to be respectful to everything and everyone, because I think that the world at large has undervalued the food savviness of LA for many, many, many years. And if you've lived in LA, you're like, yeah, it's been here, we've done it, go screw off, because we don't need you. And I knew that sentiment, and I was like, man, like, we got to win people over. And I think by winning people over is being a good neighbor and trying to incorporate as much of Los Angeles as possible. You know, it's been a lot, and I think a lot of my ideas that I've tried to do over the past 5 years, whether they were poorly executed or marketed, or maybe I was my own worst enemy by, like, talking about it too much, it allowed me to have a platform to do things that I think I've always wanted to do without the voices of anyone else.
Give me an example of something on the menu that...
I guess the best way to describe it is, like, Bill Addison just wrote about the boiled chicken. I know it's delicious. It's something my mom would make all the time. She would boil chicken on a high boil with garlic and onions. And later in culinary school, I was like, oh, you don't cook chicken that way. But I've always like, man, like her chicken soup is more delicious. And she would always take the chicken out before it would fall apart and then pick all the meat while it was hot and then dress it with salt, pepper, scallions, and sesame oil and maybe a little soy sauce sometimes. And it would absorb. And, like, you're just eating boiled chicken, and that's just the most delicious thing to me growing up. And it's still a delicious thing. And the soup would be clean but super flavorful. And I was like, I want to serve boiled chicken. And everyone's like, no, that's so not cool. And I'm like, I'm tired. I'm tired of being edited out, right? Like, we're going to do this. And I don't care if you guys think it's stupid. I know it's delicious, and we just need to give it a platform so other people can find it and taste it, because maybe they've never had it before. But there's something so heartwarming and delicious. It's just food. And how do you make food nourishing and still delicious? How do you make it, like, touch on nostalgia? And at the end of the day, like, people feel good about eating something. And that's, like, that message that I want. And I just had to cut it out. And like, I think coming out here has allowed me to get some focus again to do the things that may not be cool and maybe a little bit different. And that's okay, because if it didn't work, I was okay with that, right? Like, I think it's really important, and that's what I've been telling myself and the people at all the restaurants in New York, too. It's the thing I tell them over and over and over again. Like, don't be afraid to fall on your face.
Well, I just want to thank you for making a couple dishes at Major Domo that made me a native Angelina realize how lucky I am to have the produce around us. So at your meat-centric restaurant, I couldn't stop eating the sugar snap peas and the crudité. Yes. So thank you for that.
Yes. And I know it's so redundant, but my God, is the produce here unbelievable. And the farmers here are just a joy to work with. And the seafood, everything's great out here. And I mean, I'm really happy to be a part of this.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Evan.
The one and only David Chang. His new Netflix show is Ugly Delicious, and his new LA restaurant is Major Domo. To hear an extended version of this conversation, find it on Apple Podcasts or visit the Good Food website. Lately, it seems the rest of the country is waking up to what most of us take for granted, that LA is America's best food city. And while there is no shortage of restaurant guides, recently food writers Catherine Spires and Tin Nguyen helped curate a different kind of list for the LA Taco website.
In general, I think diversity of opinion is really good. Another reason why we decided to do this was because so many other media institutions seem to be kind of falling by the wayside.
They say it isn't meant to be a list of LA's best restaurants, but rather a guide to its culinary soul. I have to say that the Rogue 99, did you have any idea that it would be so, like, universally embraced?
No idea. I mean, we thought about doing this list mostly just to make sure that a list like this continued to exist. And we both loved Jonathan's original 99 Essentials list. We wanted to have a guide that would honor that spirit and continue the tradition. So that's what we did. And I was watching Rogue One on Netflix, and I just thought it'd be really great if we had our own version. And that's when we came up with Rogue 99.
But there's another word for it being called Rogue. Catherine, I know you worked at the LA Weekly. Some people are going to say, well, the LA Weekly still exists. Why don't we just continue to rely on the LA Weekly 99?
Yeah, well, when we first came up with the idea, it was on We Know by email. It was on December 8th. So at that point, it was only a week or so out from me and the other editors being fired. So we didn't know in what version LA Weekly was going to continue. All we knew at that point was that they didn't have the shadow staff in place that we thought was going to replace us. We were like, oh no, what if they're just going to end it all? So that was the original idea. And then it turned out that we didn't particularly care for the coverage that LA Weekly is currently doing. So it made more and more sense even as time went on to do this.
What was the workflow process like? Did you start with an old Jonathan list, for example, as a template and work from there? Or did you just divide the city up geographically and start from zero?
We actually looked at a more recent list, like lists that were done under Besha's watch, Besha Rodel's watch, and basically like slashed and burned from there. There are some institutions that'll probably never change. Providence will probably be on every Los Angeles best of restaurant that ever exists.
Appropriately so, I
absolutely.
Think.
Yeah, but we definitely had a sense of really honing in on the essential part. Essential and best are two words that with these lists, people are always fighting and getting somehow still confused over the difference between the two meanings. But we really wanted it to be the type of restaurants that generations of people have gone to or that are new and have created such a splash that new generations of people are definitely going to go to. And this is peeling back a lot of layers, but the fact that we don't have an event associated with our list means that we could choose some restaurants that maybe wouldn't sell tickets to an event, but are really part of the fabric of Los Angeles.
Because traditionally at the Weekly, there was an event.
Yeah, absolutely. Big restaurant lists for newspapers often have events tied in, and they're huge moneymakers. Ours isn't.
Well, ours is not a moneymaker.
If you published it as an actual physical guide that people could throw in their glove box.
We're looking into it. I mean, we were really lucky with LA Taco. They were super excited to support us, and they were super excited to give us a budget. They are a small publication, and we did the best with what they could give us, and what they gave us already was pretty generous. So we're hoping to publish a print version at some point. We just need a little money to do it.
So tell me some of the newer places so we get a sense of where your minds were.
I mean, well, this place is not new. Otafuku, like, I've been there several times in the last 10 years. 15 years, but I had not been there, I think, recently. And so I went back, and we were just talking about handmade noodles in Los Angeles and how popular they are. And just this idea that this Japanese place has been making fresh noodles for this long, I thought it was important to talk about it again. So I made a special trip to go back and eat there again and see what they were doing. And it's just as good as it ever was.
What's another standout, Catherine, that you can think of?
I was really happy to put the Gardena Bowl coffee shop on the list. That is a very old institution, but I don't think it's ever been on an essentials list before. But it is essential. In fact, it's a neighborhood institution, and it's attached to a bowling alley, and it serves Hawaiian food, which speaks to the culture of Gardena, which I love. So that's like an oldie but a goodie that's kind of flown under the radar. We also had a lot of help from our two contributors, Bill Esparza and Sarah Bennett, who covered some areas that are more blind spots for Tin and I. And what was great about that is really representing all the different regional Mexican food that we have in Los Angeles, putting our four brains together. I thought we actually did a good job with that.
Yeah, we finally hit Long Beach. I think historically this list has not been really great in terms of covering Long Beach. And every year I hope this list in general gets better. That's kind of the point of just building on one list after the other.
Also, there's a great deal of scope of restaurant styles. Like there are carts, taco carts, there's sit-down restaurants. Some are just middle of the night takeaway spots. Maybe give us a couple examples of those that just seem more ephemeral and odd.
Sure. The Oaxacan Quesadilla Cart in Echo Park is run by a woman named Alejandra, I think is her name.
Yep.
And she pops up. You kind of have to find her. And she speaks to the culture of street vending in Los Angeles in general. And her quesadillas are fantastic. So she's definitely worth seeking out. But she's just a little cart. It's just her in a cart.
Yeah.
And what about the midnight takeaway?
Well, one addition was Everson Royce Bar. Downtown, technically a bar. I would argue that their food is really what sets them apart. People go there specifically. These things don't go together, but their cheeseburger and their biscuits with the honey butter. Oh my gosh, not a well-rounded meal, but they do such good food there. And I think that really speaks to Los Angeles. The food has to be really amazing to get people to come back all the time, even if you are a bar. If you've got a food license, go for it.
So what is next? Are you thinking about doing something else with LA Taco?
We would definitely work with them again. This list could become an annual thing. What was really great about working with LA Taco and sort of the experimental nature of LA journalism right now is we were very clear that if they didn't let us do exactly what we wanted, we would take our business elsewhere. And they were like, okay, do whatever you want, which was great. It worked out so well for us. So we like them.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Catherine Spires, host of the Smart Mouth podcast and food writer Tin Nguyen. We've been discussing Rogue 99, LA Taco's essential LA restaurants list. Find a link to it on the Good Food website. Coming up, America is importing more of its produce than ever. Is it all bad news? Find out when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Every day, millions of tons of fruit and vegetables are transported across the globe. This exuberant trade has transformed how the world eats. But what are the pluses and minuses of importing produce, especially on farmers and consumers?
Fruit or vegetables that come from abroad vary greatly in their quality, and in some cases, it's better than the domestic equivalent.
That's pomologist David Karp.
If one were to generalize, I think I would say that there is a sacrifice to eating quality to the extent that it corresponds to coming from further away and spending more time from farm to plate.
David Karp recently wrote on imported produce for the New York Times. People are really like flinging that article all over Twitter.
People feel strongly about their food, but particularly about produce.
How much of the fruit and vegetables sold in American supermarkets now is imported?
53% of the fruit and 31%, this is as of the vegetables, as of 2016. If you exclude bananas, which have always been imported, it's gone from 3.5% to 38.5% for the fruit and for vegetables, 5.8 to 31% from 1975 to 2016. So a huge increase. And if you look at the chart, it's like a thunderbolt going straight up.
Is this all because of free trade?
Well, there's a host of factors. There's the development of shipping containers, the progress in transportation, roads being built in Mexico and around the world. There's, yes, free trade, the change in the with the WTO, the general trade agreements in the 1990s. And then very particularly, there's the APHIS, Animal Plant Health Inspection Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, as a part of that movement towards free trade, has allowed in a host of commodities. For each commodity, you need to have a particular thing, like peppers, and from a particular country, like Peru. And they've got to do a study to make sure that pests and diseases won't be introduced to American agriculture.
Let's just talk about that for a minute. When I read that statistic, that 50% statistic, I just thought to myself, I know that there's an exchange. American farmers are sending a ton of stuff out of the country. Mm-hmm. But what do fruit growers and vegetable growers feel about the possibility of pests from all of this coming in?
Well, it depends whose ox is being gored. Those who are primarily exporters, like the Northwest apple trade and the California citrus trade, depend upon exports, primarily to Asia, or the almond growers and nut growers. On the other hand, they're also concerned. The citrus people are very concerned about the introduction of diseases, apples too. Everybody is. But it's got to be a two-way street, because if you raise up excessive barriers for produce to come into the United States, then they'll do the same thing on the importing side.
I know this is something kind of outside of the scope of your article, but do you think that fruit and vegetables are going to be an easy target for a trade war if one develops?
You know, I asked that question of the Trade Council to the Secretary of Agriculture, and he declined to speculate on that. And it may very well be that he's not even sure what Trump is going to do, although I don't know that for a fact. You'd think that if we do get into a huge tit-for-tat slinging of tariffs back and forth, that agriculture will be involved. And certainly there have been several articles that farmers, including many of those in California, are concerned about that possibility. I don't think that we're ever going to see a reversal to any extent of the trend towards greater importation, because what are we going to do? Embargo all the avocados coming in from Mexico? No avocado toast.
You know, and one thing that really struck me reading the article was how our point of view here in Southern California, with the plethora of local markets that we have, affects the way I look at this landscape. So give us some examples of specific items that are being imported from particular countries.
Well, they're the tropical crops, that many of which come from Mexico, which is by far the largest exporter of produce to the United States. That could be mangoes, pineapples, limes, and avocados. They're the primary source for all of those. But then there are things like berries, which weren't grown in Mexico to any great extent until recently, particularly blackberries and raspberries. But they found out how to grow them in like Michoacan at medium elevation there so that they can supply them during our winter, the development of new varieties. Then there are types of fruit that we never used to get to imported to any extent before, like mangosteen, that are coming in from Thailand and other countries in Southeast Asia, dragon fruit. Then there's contra-seasonal fruit, just to stick with fruit for a second, from Chile primarily, but Argentina too, like peaches, apricots, nectarines, cherries, all winter long. So those are some examples of the fruits. More fruit are imported at this point than vegetables, but vegetables are starting to catch up. Why is that? Because fruits are higher in value and many of them ship better. You can ship something like cherries pretty well, even though they may not be that tasty when they arrive. Whereas if you tried to ship like lettuce from Argentina or Chile, I'm not sure that it would be worth it or they would last very well.
But asparagus from Peru?
Yes, because those are high quality, and it's interesting. That's Michael Pollan, who I interviewed for this article's bugbear, and mine too, that every time he goes to a restaurant in New York, it's asparagus is on the menu 12 months of the year. And I'm sure you feel the same way as I do. You want to get asparagus from the Stockton area where it's traditional and it's primarily in the spring. Now, it's interesting because that's one of the few crops. Most crops actually come in either by air or by boat, but that comes in both ways from Peru.
Let's talk a bit about flavor, because I think those of us who sort of have been put under the spell of local and who have access to such incredibly grown fruit, we're hesitant to buy some of these products because we feel that the flavor degrades. Is that true or not true?
Well, it depends totally on the commodity and the variety and when. Like, for example, I'll go to the market sometimes in the winter and buy, like, blackberries from Driscoll's from Mexico. And sometimes they'll be so fantastic that even my girlfriend, who doesn't particularly care for imported, she's suspicious of imported produce and whether it's contaminated with pesticides or something, that she said, oh, my God, these are great, and starts eating them all. Other times I brought them back and they were just terrible. But in general, if something degrades over time, like, for example, cherries, if they've been shipped by boat, as they often are from South America, the acidity drops, so you end up with something that looks passable but is flat.
Very bland.
What do you do about that? Well, what I do is I sneak one out of the plastic bag, the pouch they come in, and taste it, and then you know. I don't do that casually. I do it really. I'll buy them if they're good occasionally.
So let's talk a bit about that word that you said earlier, pesticides. Is imported organic the same as U.S. organic?
Well, you talk to the Organic Trade Association or to the organic center that's associated with them, and they say, well, it goes through the same process of inspection and qualifications in order to be organic. On the other hand, Michael Pollan said, I trust domestic organic more. You see a lot of anecdotal evidence about cheating going on in, like, China or Spain. There have been articles about it. I feel the same way as Michael Pollan. I mean, it's one thing to rely upon anecdotal reports, but it's another thing to have serious evidence. And I think the government does have the potential to suss out the evidence from their inspections. They just haven't done so yet. And I hope this article will lead to that.
What do you think the predictions are for continued growth? Do you think it's... So let's not talk of Southern Californians right now. Let's just have the point of view of the rest of the country that is not as fortunate as we. Is having access to all of these fruits and vegetables during the course of the year more important than recognizing the beauties of seasonality?
I think we've benefited in many ways so far. Overall, I would say on balance, the effects have been marginally positive, but it's sort of like a 60-40 thing because I'm strongly locavore-oriented personally. But if this trend continues, the disadvantages will outweigh the advantages. And when I say personally I'm a locavore, I feel strongly about eating seasonally. I don't want cherries 12 months of the year. There's a joy, as Michael Pollan speaks in the last sentence of the article, about getting a fruit, apricots, just coming into season. And that's part of being human. What is that? I think it's a spiritual or an aesthetic thing, which sounds kind of touchy-feely, but it's true. Don't you feel that way too?
Absolutely. Well, thank you, David. It's a fascinating article. And for those of us who eat mostly local, I think it's good to read. It's good to expand our horizons and have empathy for our fellow Americans who don't live where we live.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me to talk to you. I've really enjoyed it, Evan.
That's David Karp. He calls himself the Fruit Detective, and we've been talking about the increase of imported produce in the U.S. Find a link to his recent New York Times article on the Good Food website. And now a visit with L.A. Times food critic Jonathan Gold. He recently came back from a very memorable trip. So you have pretty recently come back from a trip to Copenhagen.
I have.
Where you experienced the renewal, reimagined NoMa.
It seems weird. I go to NoMa a lot, and we talk about it on the show probably more than we do a lot of local restaurants. But it's a restaurant that I feel a lot of affection for, and I feel that it's sort of at the heart of what's going on in world cuisine right now.
So describe the difference in the restaurant now compared to what it was just physically.
The old NoMa was in the ground floor of what used to be a whale blubber warehouse. It was lovely and rustic and had fur throws on the seats and no tablecloths. And it didn't feel like you were in somebody's living room exactly. There's no way that this would be somebody's living room, but it had a great view, you know, across the Copenhagen Harbor. And it just felt like you were there. They moved not that far away, maybe half a mile, maybe a mile, to this abandoned, I think it was an armaments storage facility for the Navy. The walls were very thick because they didn't want the explosion to take out half of Copenhagen.
Does it still have that same sort of casual rusticity?
It does. It seems very rustic. It seems like somebody's, you know, great lake house. you can dress up to go there or you can wear a sweater to go there and you wouldn't feel out of place either way. The old Noma could have gone on forever, right? There are probably thousands of requests for seats for every seat that they actually have available, that it's always sort of hovers near the top of the world's best restaurants list. It's definitively the restaurant where the best chefs, or at least in my estimation, the best chefs want to go and stage. It could have kept going on as it was forever. But there's this sort of restlessness in René Redzepi's soul, I think. I mean, part of the thing that led him to close the restaurants down for a couple of months each year and open pop-ups in places like, you know, Mexico and Australia or Tokyo. And I think he felt trapped. I think that he probably was looking forward and saw a lifetime of serving, you know, pickled rose petals to rich tourists. And it didn't appeal to him that much. So he wanted to be able to expand. He wanted to be in a place where he could do something different, a place where he had a future instead of just a glorious storied past.
How has that been expressed? No more pickled rose petals for wealthy tourists?
Oh, there's plenty of pickled rose petals, and the prefix is $350, something like that, you know, plus a wine pairing or a juice pairing.
Is the menu different in any way from what the menus were like at the previous space?
For the first time, I think they've decided to change the menus as a whole 3 or 4 times a year in the way that when you went to a meal at Noma Mexico, you repeated absolutely 0 courses from before. And the first of his menus explores the sea, even in a depth that he hadn't done before at Noma. And there was a lot of seafood on his menu. So you'll start with like a rich bouillon made of snails, sip from a shell smeared with herbs, or a plate with a field of empty cockle shells and 2 or 3 contain the sweet meat. He does a Frankenstein thing where he takes the chewy outer part of a lot of mussels and constructs it into what looks like one single mussel.
Oh, I love that.
There's a rough earthen plate that has a star made of egg yolks, possibly a touch of cream, that's paved with the most delicate cured trout roe. And what may be the most unsettling thing he has, and we're talking about a menu that includes both 100-year-old clams and a 50-year-old mussel, is what looks very much like a whole raw moon jelly on a plate.
What is that?
Those jellyfish that you see when you go to aquariums that turn luminous in the ultraviolet light in which they're invariably bathed. And they have those markings in them. And you look down, the markings are there. And you start to eat it. And you're a little trepidatious because it's like, I don't know, I go to aquariums a lot. And this is like going to zoos a lot. And you finally you're going to take your first bite of tiger. And it just feels
wrong.
And
then you discover?
That, in fact, the kitchen had fashioned the jellyfish from squid juice that they had reduced and gelled, and that the markings were drawn on the bottom of the plate.
I love that.
With sauce. And it was kind of great. Apparently, raw jellyfish is really, really unpalatable. My favorite part of the meal may have been sort of a multi-course take on, you know, the classic seafood plateau, the big seafood platters you get in France that included like those mahogany clams that I was telling you about that are a century old. It's very strange to think of eating something that was alive during World War I. There was a dish of sea urchin that was studded with blanched, peeled pumpkin seeds. Can you imagine how much
work? I saw a picture of that. It just looks insane.
It almost looks like something designed to like torture your kitchen staff. There was this dish that was almost magical in its strangeness, which was this little cup of crunchy dried sea cucumber insides that was garnished on the rock that it sat on with a glistening raw sea cucumber the size of a rugby ball.
Were you meant to eat that?
No, no. But I think it was just meant to be there as...
It was just a little piece of performance.
It was a piece of performance art, yeah.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, Jonathan Gold. We've been talking about his recent trip to Noma in Copenhagen. Text the words good food to 69866 for Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. After the break, the market report, plus our friend Adam Perry Lang with some tips on making a Passover specialty.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Now let's hand it over to Laura Avery, who's at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Hi, this is Laura Avery. I'm here at the Farmers Market today with Ella Freyinger, who is a caterer and private chef. She's been coming to the market for years. And Ella, you're here today. It's spring. What are you finding spring-like at the market?
Hi, Laura. Well, today I'm so excited because now we're officially in spring, and we're starting to see all these yummy little things pop up at the market, all green and sweet and young and tender. And today I'm really excited about picking up some snap peas to use for a pop-up that we have coming up in a couple of weeks.
Okay, sugar snap peas. Now, there are sugar snap peas, there are snow peas, and there are English shelling peas. Tell us how you find the best sugar snap peas and describe what they look like.
So a sugar snap pea is kind of between an English pea and a snow pea. It's a little bit plumper than a snow pea, but it's also going to be a little bit smaller than an English pea, and you're not going to see that little bump on the outside where the actual bean is inside. Mm-hmm. And I love to pick them. You want the outside to look really smooth and tight, and you want them to not be able to kind of bend them. You want them to feel really crisp, and if you kind of bend them in half, they'll just kind of crunch.
Okay, and this is also the pea that it's got the little peas inside, but actually it's the pod itself that's the big star of this particular item.
Absolutely. So the thing I love about sugar snap peas is you get that sweetness of a green pea, but you also get that really great crunch from the outside, which you're not going to get with an English pea and not as much with a snow pea when you cook that. That's going to get a little bit softer. So in terms of recipe that we're going to make with these snap peas, what I love to do is on a wood-fired grill, and at home you could do this in a cast iron or under your broiler if you don't want to turn the grill on. I like to just cook the snap peas on one side without any oil, any salt, anything, just so we get a nice clean char on one side, and we end up with a really still almost raw crisp on the other side. So you get that combination of like the really sweet, crisp sugar snap pea, which is like nature's candy, along with that really smoky kind of charred side.
Okay, and how long does that take to char? Are you watching them like a hawk?
Yes, we are watching them like a hawk. It takes, depending on how hot your grill is, we do them in about 2 to 3 minutes because we do them very, very close to the flame.
Okay, and then they come off the grill and then you're not shocking them or plunging them. You just let them sit there and bubble.
Yeah, we actually like to serve them at room temperature. We don't serve them hot. So we get the nice char on one side, we let them cool down, and while that's happening, we use one of our other favorite spring ingredients, which is green garlic. And we char that up as well, and we like to use that to make a little salsa verde with some basil, some parsley, and if you want to get really complex with your flavors, you can even add in a little raw garlic or some roasted garlic to kind of deepen that garlic flavor. And then we just toss the snap peas with that and like to add in like a little cooling creamy component against the smokiness and kind of the astringency that you can get with garlic sometimes, just in like a little seasoned Greek yogurt that just has like a little olive oil, salt, and pepper in it, and keep it nice and simple and let the sweetness of the snap pea kind of shine through.
Mm, as a salad, as a side, as a accompaniment to pretty much anything.
Yes, we serve it as a side dish to go along with a little bit of a roasted lamb, which mm-hmm. is absolutely delicious for the beginning of spring. And it's just a really great way to showcase multiple spring ingredients in the same dish.
So, Ella, for people who want to come to your pop-up on April 6th and 7th, where do they get information about tickets?
So you go to www.ellafreyinger.com. The pop-up is in Highland Park, and a portion of the proceeds are going to be going to Young Hearts.
Thanks, Ella.
Thank you, Laura.
I'm talking now with Barbara Wyman, who is the person, the face, the personality at Tutti Frutti Farm down here on the Wednesday Farmers Market. And Barbara, we need to talk to you about how are these snap peas at your booth grown up there in Tutti Frutti?
Well, to have them this early, we are growing them under hoop houses. It's not a hothouse. They're grown outside. It's just the same as how we start our tomatoes. They're covered just like with our tent, except for the tents come to the ground, so we can start them a little earlier, especially this year with the freeze we had.
Mm-hmm. And how big do the plants get?
They can get up to 6 feet. I've walked through them many times, and, you know, once they're full grown, you're looking up at them. So I'd say about 6 feet. They are poled.
They're poled. They're not hanging on those strings from the ceiling. They're on stakes.
We have those wooden stakes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so they take a long time to grow or not?
I find the average of most item is from the time you plant, because we buy the plants, you know, it's just with farming, it's just not feasible to start everything from seed. So we start from plants and they're pretty small. But it's an average of 3 months, I'd say, from the time you plant it until you can start picking them.
Okay, and then how many times can you keep picking one plant?
Well, yeah, because the plant keeps producing, you know, the peas individually, it's not like some plants, oh, everything at once. We usually, once we plant them, we can pick them for about 2 months. Because as with most things, we have to do the consecutive planting where, you know, you just, this row here, you plant it this time. A month later, you plant another row. Mm-hmm. So that way you can spread it over a few months. Well, mm-hmm. with pea season, we usually have them, what, from February until May. Mm-hmm. But, you know, out of one plant, that wouldn't be possible. You have to do the consecutive planting.
Okay, Barbie, you say you got them in the hoop houses now. Will you transition to outdoors later in the season?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's, you know, a lot more expense to maintain and keep hoop houses up. Once there's no more chance of freeze and, you know, it's consistent warmth, and that way you can get the sun directly on the plants too. And the hoop houses gives us usually at least a month earlier, you know, which, and people are just waiting to get peas as soon as possible.
Yes, so true. It's so true. They're so delicious. Okay, Barbara, well, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That was Barbara Wyman. She is the face of Tutti Frutti Farms here at the Wednesday Farmers Market, and she probably knows just as much about farming as farmer Chris Cadwell himself. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Recently, I took a turn in a pop-up called Knadel Bar. Each chef who participates serves a bowl of soup with knadel or matzo balls. Chef Adam Perry Lang offered to help me with service, and who was I to say no? But little did I know that he would offer up a lesson on the physics of the dumpling so many of us stress over this time of year. Hi there.
Hi.
I know you're on your way to your place that you're in the process of building, so thank you for giving me the time.
I'm always up for talking about matzo balls.
Okay, so I imagine you grew up eating them, but when was the first time you actually made a batch?
Oh my gosh, I don't even remember. I can remember a lot of bad ones, that's for sure. I guess just really making it every year at the holidays for, you know, for Passover. So for me, it was just always very just seasonal. But then it became something a bit different for me. It was more about nurturing. I love making chicken soup for people and matzo balls. And I mean, when you think about the matzo ball, it's very interesting because when you eat it and you swallow it, it kind of holds the heat in your chest.
It's absolutely true. It does.
Yeah. And I think that's really part of it that makes matzo balls so special and so healing.
And yet, you remember a lot of bad ones. So knowing you, as I do, a supreme tinkerer, how did you go about conquering the matzo ball?
I really just took a close look at the directions on the package. I took a look at it, and I wanted to understand why are some matzo balls super dense and why are some not? What I came up with is I really started to understand this concept of letting it rest, but having aeration while it rests and chilling it so that it aerates and then it holds. And then once you scoop it and put it into the boiling pot of salted water, it immediately holds its shape. So it's light and airy. But if you roll it, it's really bad. I use an ice cream scoop.
Because the tendency is to want them to look perfect when they're in your hand.
It's true, but listen, you know, there is a time and a place for like a dense matzo ball, you know? So, I mean, if we're talking about what I consider people to think about matzo ball nirvana, it's really light and fluffy and very big.
Okay, so first let's start with the aeration while it's resting. Does that mean that you make it with sparkling water?
Well, it's not sparkling water. It has to be seltzer, preferably New York seltzer. from a bottle. I don't know where to get it yet. So I have to then go to the next denominator, which is freshly opened seltzer from a glass bottle.
So you're trying to capture the bubbles.
Right. You want to capture the bubbles. And also, I kind of broke apart the recipe on the package because I think that they figured it'd be too lengthy to do this. But it's really great to whip the egg whites, okay, and separate the yolks into it and then fold in the yolks, okay? You don't have to go crazy. No hard peaks. Very soft, and it's got to just be silky. If you go too tight with the bubbles, it's not good enough.
And how long do you let it rest, the batter?
Well, you know what? This is the key thing. You put it into a glass bowl or a metal bowl, something that's going to really conduct the chill. You put it in the bowl and you put it into the fridge, covered in plastic wrap, and you leave it alone for 45 minutes.
So I've always been doing them, leaving them overnight. That's too long?
I don't know if it's too long. I just never have the patience for that.
Okay. And
I've never had the patience to test it. I'm always like, if I'm in the mood for matzo balls, I'm making it. I'm just praying for 45 minutes to come quick enough.
My problem that happens sometimes, not all the time, is I will scoop them or gently spoon them out into the water, and then I will put the lid on and boil them. But then after the allotted time, a half hour, 40 minutes, I take out a tester and I cut it in half, and there's this beautiful fluffy ring that goes into the ball, maybe, if I'm lucky, a half an inch. But then the rest of it into the center still has that raw color.
That's because you have to build up pressure, you know. So I recommend when cooking matzo balls, first of all, it's boiling salted water. Do not cook them in chicken stock. It gets gummy. You don't want the collagen into this fluffy, you know, matzo ball, okay? So you cook it in boiled salted water. And when you drop them in, you take a really large scoop and you kind of just like curl it lightly. And then you just like kind of just shape it on the other side. So that then you drop it into the boiling salted water. And I really recommend like a pot, like a Creuset, which is really has like really quick recovery. So it's boiling. You're dropping them in as quick as you can. Just think, you know, basically fill them up a little bit less than 2/3 and close the lid. I like Creuset because it's got a heavy lid. If you don't, you can put something heavy on top. But as soon as you put the lid on, just reduce what you think it will be at simmer. And you cannot open the lid for 40 minutes.
No peeking.
No, because you have to build up that pressure because it's really like violent in there. So it's kind of like cooking like the matzo ball to kind of almost souffle.
So interesting. It's almost like pressure cooking the matzo ball.
It is. It's 100% without really drawing a lot of pressure, but it is. That's pressure cooking.
I cannot thank you enough.
Oh, my pleasure.
Take care, Adam.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
That was Adam Perry Lang teaching us about knedel or matzo balls. Look for his knedel bar pop-up sometime in the future. In the weeks ahead, we'll be sharing my conversation with Adam about his new steakhouse, APL, which opens in Hollywood this spring. Thanks for listening to Good Food. If you missed any part of this week's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. And remember to find us on Apple Podcasts for a full-length version of my interview with David Chang. Also this Monday, we'll be sharing a bonus episode of Good Food featuring more highlights from the Food Book Fair LA. Many thanks to the Good Food team. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.